Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll make a start. Thank you so much for coming. My name is Andrew Harrop. I'm the General Secretary of the Fabian Society. The topic for this evening, 2 months before the spending round that we're expecting from the Chancellor, is a blank cheque. What can Austerity Britain afford for older people? And this is one element of a really interesting project that we've been working on over the last 4 or 5 months. It's interesting because of the partners who have come together to work on it. Independent Age and RNIB came together and said to us, as a collection of three think tanks with very different views, would we work together on a cross-party project on the spending review and where it should go for ageing? We were delighted to do so. And that led both to three events at the different party conferences, but also to a report that's on your chairs, which is a really good read. Some experts in the sector coming together with some very provocative thoughts on spending and ageing. And before I go any further, we've got a signer with us. Is there anyone who's using the signer? Could you identify yourself if you are using the signer? Otherwise, I won't ask her to continue. Great, okay. And also, if you're using a hearing aid, then it will work on the R setting if you want to adjust your hearing aid. So the contributions in the report, which you'll see, range very widely, looking at future of the pension system, the role of the family in ageing Britain, obviously health and care issues, but also a good focus on housing. It shows in the breadth of contributions that we've brought together how complicated, if you like, the implications of an ageing society are for both, obviously, our changing lives as families, but also for the role of government and the role of public spending. And I want to explore those issues with our panellists this evening. So I'm going to introduce each of them in turn. We have Debbie Abrahams, who is the new Shadow Minister for Disabled People. Then we've got Dawn Foster, specialist journalist who's written a lot in this area. Janet Morrison from Independent Age, and then Ellie Southwood from RNIB. So four excellent speakers to kick us off, but then there'll be plenty of time for questions and discussion after that. Debbie, over to you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Really appreciate it. Can everybody hear me, first of all? You okay? If you can't hear me, please wave. I've got a mic in front of me, but I'm not sure if it's picking my voice up. But if you can't hear, please wave, and I'll make sure that I raise my voice. I wanted to start with a couple of incidents that happened in the last few months, actually, when I was out doing my regular door knocks, and I came across. This is in the middle of the afternoon. I knocked on a door in a nice part of Saddleworth, where part of my constituency is. And a woman, probably in her mid to late 70s, opened the door. She was dishevelled, confused. She was still in her night clothes. And she just literally opened the door and presented to me an empty pack of medication, a bubble pack of medication, and said to me, "I don't know what I have to do." Now, fortunately, I was able to phone the pharmacist. They were very good. They came up, and I left reassured that they would be sorting out her medication. But this was clearly somebody that was should have had support and wasn't receiving that. Another incident, I knocked on the door, it was just before the election, and it was an older man in his mid to late 70s as well, and he said, "What is Labour going to do for me? I have a daughter, a grown-up daughter with learning disabilities, She's also physically disabled, and I'm currently her sole carer. So when we go on saying the piece in the booklet, I could give a whole gamut of examples of cases like this. So when we're looking at what can we afford to do, I said, what can we not afford to do? We are still the sixth wealthiest country in the world. And I've just given you some examples of what I think were vulnerable people who weren't getting the support that they should have had. And I think it's a failure of our political system, and that's all parties. I think we have kicked into the long grass the issues around the fact that we have an ageing society, and the solutions around that are seen politically, have been seen as politically too complex or too sensitive to address. And I, you know, as a relatively new MP, certainly a very new shadow minister, I think that's something that we really need to grapple with. Some of the facts that I just wanted to raise. Currently we have 10 million people who are over 65 now. In the next 30, by 2050, that will have doubled. And we will have 8 million people at that time who will be over 80 years. Now, I don't have the ratio of working to older people, because I know that has gone dramatically down in the last, certainly since the 60s. We're all living older, longer rather, but we're not all living in good health. And some people are living longer, more than others. So in my own constituency, there's an 11-year life expectancy gap. And there's also an equivalent healthy life expectancy gap, how long we can expect to live in good health. £3.5 billion have been cut from social care. 87% of social services departments only able to provide support for people with substantial or critical needs. 500,000 people, older people, admitted by blue light to A&E over the last few years. And delayed discharges since 2010 have cost the health service over £525 million. We're failing to provide basic care, and I think we have an incredibly inefficient system. And while this is happening, the government that we currently have is looking even harder at how we can privatise health services, and we have an insurance system that is dying to pick up the opportunities that will provide. From my point of view, I think we definitely need to be moving towards a system where we have a care system that's provided on the same basis as our health system. And I think we need to be bold about this. We really do. Now, there are huge cost implications, but I think we need to be bold. I know, you know, certainly over the last few months it has been a hot topic within the party. Just a couple of points around pensions. There have been a lot of developments over the last 10, 15 years. The Pensions Act that we brought in did have seen significant advantages and developments around pensions. It's not perfect by any means, but we have the lowest level of pensioner poverty that we have seen in 30 years. I think in terms of the developments around auto-enrolment to make sure that people in the private sector employment also have protection in their later years. We haven't seen those protections for people, for example, on low income. Certainly there have been considerable erosion in what was intended to happen, for example, in the delays and the opting out ability for people and for businesses with people on lower incomes. People on zero-hour contracts, seasonal workers, also similarly having considerable disadvantage in the auto-enrolment sector. So I think there are there have been developments, but we need to be mindful that this isn't in relation to pensions. We have a lot more to do in that area, particularly, as I say, for people on lower incomes and on seasonal work and so on. I think we also need to be more bold in terms of when we're looking at metrics around determining state pension age. I mentioned right at the beginning around healthy life expectancy and life expectancy. I think we need to be having a rethink about that. I'm sure insurance providers will love me for that, but it does seem, again, a real injustice that people in different parts of the country and different sectors will be in worse health and retiring at the same age as somebody who has better health. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But before I turn to the other speakers, Debbie, your final remarks there on state pension age, and they reflect things that Jeremy said during his campaign, and he opened up the thought of delaying or changing the approach we're taking to state pension age. Is this the sign of a shift in the party and a breaking of a cross-party consensus that we thought we had established?
Well, no, not from my remarks I made when I wrote this piece, and I oppose it. We should be reviewing the metrics that we use. Jeremy may over.
It's not party policy, but it's Jeremy's views.
So we happen to coincidentally have said similar things. So, we're very, it's very, very early on.
But it's actually a really important crossover with your disability brief, because the number of people who will be disabled in their 60s but not yet at pension age is going to be incredibly high in future decades. The other big pledge Jeremy made in campaigning for the leadership in this area is to restore social care cuts, which would be, of course, an incredibly expensive commitment. But many people say that this is the most underfunded public service in desperate situation. I'm going to turn to Dawn now, from a sort of a more independent perspective. can we just have a blank check for older people in this spending review?
I wonder if we're going to have a check at all at this point. Just before I start, can I thank the Fabians for having an all-women panel on something that isn't women, which is the first time I've ever seen this happen. So I'd really like to thank you for doing that.
With a token male chair.
Yes. It's fine, we can put up with it. So I spend a lot of my time going to the most unglamorous parts of the UK. And I can say that because I come from Newport in South Wales, which if you ever go there, it's not really glamorous. So I'm not saying this from a position of privilege. I spend a lot of time going to Scunthorpe, Toxteth, various parts of Glasgow, and speaking to people about how they are being impacted by cuts and how their lives are impacted by inequality and poverty and, as Debbie said, injustice. And one thing that worries me a lot, I write a lot about housing, and one thing that worries me a lot is there is a big invective around baby boomers at the moment. And that wasn't really a term I'd heard growing up in a council estate in South Wales, because my family had weren't boomers. They were just working class people who had always been poor, and then their children were poor, and then somebody like me accidentally breaks out and becomes relatively wealthy. So I'd never really heard the term baby boomers before, and then the housing crisis started to happen, and I heard a lot of people talk about intergenerational justice, and a lot of people saying, well, our parents had a lot of money, they had free university and they got good houses, and now we've got nothing. But what I spend a lot of time doing is going to see older people who live in poorer areas around the UK, and they are suffering as much, if not more, as everybody else. I went to Scunthorpe recently and I met a woman in her late 80s, and she had a carer come in for 30 minutes in the morning to help her get dressed and 30 minutes in the evening to help her get undressed. And that was the only care she had. Mm-hmm. Her son had severe learning difficulties and tried to help care for her as much as possible. I went to the house and it was quite clear that it was completely out of control. Mm-hmm. She was struggling to get her medication. Mm-hmm. she called me beforehand and said, I'm really, really sorry, I know you're a journalist, but could you bring some toilet roll? We haven't had toilet roll for 5 days. Because her son would go to the shop and get confused and bring back something completely different. And she couldn't ask the carer to do it because the carer said that the carer couldn't go out and use their own money, and they were contracted only to come back and do that for them. And I've seen so many of these cases around the UK, and what really, really concerns me, especially in the housing issue, is that most of these people could go into care, but are worried that the only way they can afford to do that is by selling their house, and their house is the only asset they have. They have really, really small pensions, but they've accidentally ended up with a house that could be their only asset. But at the same time, they don't want to lose any of their independence. And at the same time, the amount of care they get from the council is almost non-existent. And so, and they're struggling, and it's awful. But at the same time, whenever I speak to these people, all they say is, if I sell the house and go into care, what do my children have? So all of these people just want to, all they want to do is help their families after they go. And in the meantime, are going through absolute hell, trying to remain independent, trying to keep hold of the house, but not actually being able to get the care they need. And I think we have to get to a point where we say, as a society, these people shouldn't be invisible, but they are at the moment, and we actually do need to help these people as much as we help everybody else. I mean, Debbie spoke briefly about the life expectancy gap that exists in many, many parts of the UK. What I find even worse is the healthy life expectancy gap. So in many parts of the UK, I mean, so in Newport, where I grew up, your healthy life expectancy is 40. So once you get to 40, the likelihood is that you will have at least one disability that massively impacts on your life. Whereas if you live in Kensington, your healthy life expectancy is 65. And that's a huge, huge thing. And we think a lot about older people only needing care, but it starts a lot earlier. And in poorer areas, you know, it's unbelievable. And, I mean, I was in Liverpool recently, and I was speaking to them about the cuts. And one of the councillors said to me, we're quite proud of the fact that so far we haven't closed rape crisis centres, we haven't closed children's services, we haven't closed libraries, we haven't stopped care. But this is the final point. We can't go any further. And we have to decide what we do. And I find it terrible that we get to the point where we have what I coin an intergenerational war. Where we have young people saying, I can't afford to buy a house, and you could, why have you done this to us? When at the same time we have a lot of very, very poor people, a lot of disabled people who are in unbelievable hardship. And basically because of the cuts and because of what will come up in the spending review, we are reaching a breaking point in society. And I feel that often older people and disabled people and people who need care are completely overlooked. And I think it's going to get to a point where we actually get quite a few big, horrible stories that make us realise how bad this has gotten. And I think we have to get to a point where we really genuinely invest very, very, you know, like purposefully into older care, into disabled care, and into actually building a society that looks after each other. And I think that will come very, very soon. And I think the spending review might be the point where people actually say, enough is enough, we can't deal with any more cuts.
Thank you very much, Dawn. You've highlighted there the terrible straits that local government, including so many Labour councils, are going to be in, and the choices they'll have to make between different very high priority groups who all have a good call on it. I think it's quite likely that, you know, councils won't be able to cope, but also the private care operators. So, you know, I think we'll see at least one of them go out of business if they're mainly dependent on public sector work. Janet, with that gloomy thought, let me hand over to you and hear the independent age perspective.
Okay, I hope you're not relying on me to cheer everyone up.
No.
Independent age provides information and advice to older people, particularly the older and their families and carers. And the evidence that we receive is people, firstly, struggling even to know where to go to get independent advice. But by the time they get to us, they're experiencing really severe crisis problems about navigating just within and between health and social care. So they're really struggling. And they're really struggling to know what they're entitled to and what support they can accept. And often they have quite depressingly low expectations of being able to expect anything. Mm-hmm. So a lot of self-funders, and you don't actually have to be terribly rich to be a self-funder, but a lot of self-funders assume that the local authority has no duty towards them, and they're really struggling to piece mm-hmm. together with very inaccurate advice the support and services that they need for their older relatives. What we also see is, real struggles with quality and consistency of home care. And we've talked about, and we know about the 15-minute visits and the 30-minute visits. I'm involved with a new social finance initiative that is funded through CCGs, and it's results-based. And we cannot help lonely and isolated older people who already get social care support. And, you know, we know that that may be the two visits, but we can't help them because we know at least they've got a little bit of coverage, but there are loads of people who get no coverage. Mm. So there's a real problem there. We also see a lot of people piece together a bit of care, and then the next crisis happens and it doesn't adapt and it isn't suitable for the ongoing needs of their family member. And also, now I'm afraid to say, the result of some of the exposures that we've seen about abuse and neglect in care homes has created a real fear about going into residential care. And I have to say, although people do want to stay in their own homes, sometimes their own homes become a trap because they are not adapted to their needs. And they're not going to meet their future needs. And sometimes when the crisis gets to a certain point, actually residential care is the right choice for someone. But we've now got to a stage where we don't know what to look for, and we have fears about quality and safety in the care home market. So that, coupled with the pressures on financing care homes — I used to run care homes and we don't anymore, because it is very difficult to balance those books and to invest to keep up the quality and the training and the fabric that you need in a care home. So what we see is this lack of suitable housing supply and a lack of a really coherent and consistent framework that everyone knows what they're entitled to in terms of health and social care. And of course, what we see is we're falling back on carers, and that has very significant impacts on them as well in terms of the informal care that they can give, but also on their own health and well-being. So that's what we experience, trying to struggle with people who come to understand, can I get, dementia care isn't funded under the NHS, or can I make a case for it to be continuing care, and all the complexity of trying to make their case. So what we think of independent ages, that what we're calling for really is, we do need now, as a society and cross-party, to have a real public debate about the future of both health and social care. And lots of people feel very passionate about the NHS, but they also need to feel as passionate about social care, because without an integrated system, what we see is what was referred to before about A&E departments having lots of older people coming in at the beginning of the year simply because they do not have the social care packages they need to remain at home and to remain independent. And as we know, the NHS has had its funding protected, so it has increased by 19% since 2010. But social care has fallen by 10% since 2010. And so there's 360,000 fewer older people who are getting state-funded care. And that simply is just going to create pressures back into the NHS if we don't address it. So we have to explain this to the public, that a new settlement needs to cover health and social care, and it needs to also stimulate the right kind of lifetime housing that we need, not just for first-time buyers, but also for older people to be able to perhaps downsize or move into more suitable accommodation. So what we'd like to see is also that new settlement needs to look at how can we pay for better health and social care. The Barker Commission came up with some very useful suggestions last year. There are ways that we can look at the gearings and the choices that we make, but at some point we will have to consider that some people may have to pay more, because otherwise those that work will not be able to, in any case, support their families to get the quality of care that they need. So, and ultimately, I think we need to design a system that has better pathways, has better rights and choices for people, so they have a chance to make better choices earlier on before they end up in crisis.
Thank you very much, Janet. In my chapter in this report, I talk about the issues you just talked about and argue that we need a much better funded health and care system but that older people should make the contribution towards that. So it's a very difficult debate to be had about the tax contributions that older people make, as well as getting a much better service for health and care needs. My father-in-law is unfortunately exactly the sort of person you just talked about. He was in and out of A&E 5 times in the last month or so because he couldn't use his medication. A one care visit a day would have sorted that out. Over to you, Ellie, who's both wearing an RNIB hat, but I should say is a Fabian Society activist, so delighted to have you here as well.
thank you very much, and again, to really like to thank the Fabians for putting this together, because I think there are some really, really challenging questions, not only about the amount of funding, but of course about who provides that funding and the extent to which other generations are content to do that, and the extent to which older people themselves are willing and or able to do that too. So my perspective on this is from, I suppose, the point of view of one particular experience that many, many older people have. At the moment, there are 1.8 million people in the UK with sight loss. That's projected to increase to 4 million by 2050. So that is double the amount of people who currently require treatment and support. That's a huge strain on an NHS in terms of treatment that is already creaking. So demands for treatment for AMD, for particular sight loss related to diabetes and to cataracts, will hugely increase. And with that, of course, comes a huge potential cost. And of course, you know, people expect the NHS to be there for them when that happens. I mean, if you've lived a life in which you've, you know, paid tax, national insurance, you get to 85, 90, and the thing that we know, according to research, is most feared is taken away, which is your sight. Why would you not expect the NHS to be there for you, to provide you with the treatment you need? The nature of the population who are older will also shift. And I suppose this is probably a more personal reflection, but I think it's interesting. We talked a little bit, other people have talked about the expectations people have, and I think that's right. I think expectations are pretty low at the moment. I suspect that might change over the next 20, 30 years, when the people who are now 60 and who are digitally included, have access to lots of deals online, are online and able to participate, want the same opportunities that they have now when they are 80, 85. So I suspect the nature of the demand might shift as well. And of course, an increasing awareness of how much things cost and who is funding, I suspect might create some challenges around, you know, what is expected. Talked about our NHS, which clearly is already creaking, and the worst thing from a sight loss point of view, I suppose, is that 50% of sight loss is entirely avoidable in the UK if it's treated early enough, if it's diagnosed early enough. So, you know, I don't need to explain the consequence of a health service which is already rationalising treatment on 50% of people who need not experience sight loss. The impact of sight loss in terms of the support that people need is financially challenging, but it's also hugely, you know, emotionally challenging as well. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, really, was the kind of the impact on individuals of losing sight, and this is related to the points that have been made before about social care and what's happening there as well. So quite often when people lose sight, what happens to them in the eye clinic is that they are seen by a clinician whose job is sort of done, in the sense that they can't do any more, because, you know, from a very medical point of view, of course, if they're no longer able to save any sight, no longer able to restore any sight, that's sort of the end of the road from their point of view. There is an assumption out there that what happens then is you'll go into a system and be supported by somebody who can help you get in touch with the right charities, with the right support you need from social services. And I guess I wouldn't be making the point if that were true. It's incredibly patchy, incredibly patchy. And really, the number of people who ring the RNIB group helpline and say, oh, 3 years ago, you know, I was sat in a doctor's office and they told me I was going blind and I got on the bus and went home. And I haven't spoken to anybody since. And that is what is happening. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think, you know, Dawn really helpfully helped us to talk about some real people and real lives, because when we talk about big numbers and systems, I think it's really easy to get, you know, for people to get lost in that discussion, as indeed people are getting lost in those very systems all the time. The social care side of it, so local authorities, and I should also say the other hat I wear is I'm actually a cabinet member on Brent Council, and the choices are real. So we've taken 89 million out of our budget over the last couple of years. We're tasked with, well, subject to obviously what we're given, which will presumably not increase, another 50 million from here on in each year. That is not something you can do without making some really, really hard choices. And already, you know, our eligibility criteria has been tightened up, which leaves a lot of people who are sort of muddling along, getting their own informal care, incredibly vulnerable, because actually they're very often not on the radar. And so when we make other policy choices across the council about, I don't know, even down to, you know, things like visitor parking charges, well, a lot of those visitors might well be providing the very care that 10 years ago the local authority might have been providing. So for people with sight loss, that might be learning to navigate your own home. You know, if suddenly your home becomes somewhere that you're used to getting around by seeing, how do you learn that actually it is, you know, you can manage the stairs, you can manage to make a cup of tea, provided that you have the right support. And often that's quite simple support, but if you don't get it, how would you know? Mm-hmm. How would you ever know? And so, you know, there is a huge, huge issue there. And I think a concern that I have about integrating health and social care is clearly the right thing to do. But we have to be really careful that social care doesn't get lost, because the acute need for NHS spending is, you know, is extreme. And actually, if we ploughed all of that money into, you know, reducing A&E waiting times and all the other things that are really important, we have to be very careful not to lose track of the social care side of thing. So, you know, obviously we know we need lots more money. Will we get a blank check? Very unlikely. Our health system is already creaking. Our social care system is also really struggling. And we have a doubling in the population who are going to need either treatment or support. So, you know, those people who don't get that are at increased risk of being isolated. I mean, that's the other really, I think the thing that to be honest, you know, when I sit in on helpline calls that I find hardest is that level of social isolation, that level of, well, if I'm blind, my friends won't want to know me anymore. How will I get a bus to my, you know, lunch club that I'm used to going to? All of those things. And we know the costs of social isolation are huge. So I don't think we'll get the blank check we need, but I think that, you know, I think as Debbie opened with, actually the cost of not meeting these challenges, not just financially in terms of investing to save, but actually for our society, are far, far too great to risk.
Thank you very much. I want to, as the first contribution from the floor, bring in one of the other authors of the report. I said it was a cross-party conversation, and we worked with Centre Forum, who are a Liberal think tank, and Bright Blue, who are a Conservative think tank. And I want to invite Ryan Shorthouse, who's the director of Bright Blue, to say a few words about his contribution in particular. Is there a mic near you? Can you? Have we got a mic? Yeah. Shout for us, thank you.
So thank you very much. For coming together, all the organisations, particularly thanks to our NIB and Independent Age, and I hope you enjoy reading the essay collection. A lot of the comments here are talking about the role of government, and what I try to do in my essay is look at the role that families play in providing welfare and other support. And there is a perception, I think, that the baby boomers are quite selfish, that they've hogged the houses, not suffered as much under the Chancellor's Acts, but actually they're very much a giving generation, and the evidence suggests they're giving quite a lot in financial and practical support, which is helping, for example, children get on the poverty ladder. But it's not just a middle class thing. We know from evidence that low income households are also giving a lot of intergenerational transfers, which are helping their children avoid debt, practical support, the childcare, which is saving them a lot of money. So the big thing that I tried to say was that there are two main issues that come from that. The first is around the inequality that emerges, that very wealthy parents, for example, can give a lot more money to their adult children, and that causes further inequalities. And the second is that some people can't transfer resources to their children, and what do we do with those people? So there are some innovative ideas there around helping people on low incomes who are baby boomers, giving both financial and practical support. How can we unlock that further? So I hope you enjoy reading it, but I've got a question for the panel. So one thing that I said was we shouldn't penalise people who are very wealthy giving money to their children. So I was very sceptical of raising inheritance tax, for example, which I thought was being punitive towards that. Instead, I said what we should be doing is trying to unlock the resources that low-income baby boomers would like to give but can't give at the moment because they haven't got the time or the resources. So we try to come up with practical ways of enabling that rather than penalising people right at the top with higher rates of taxation. And I just wanted to know whether you thought that was the right approach or whether you would, in fact, seek more through inheritance tax.
Thank you, Ryan. And that was touched on by the Shadow Chancellor earlier as well. Debbie, you said you need to slip away a tiny bit early, so I just want to take a couple more questions directly to Debbie so that we get the most of your views that we possibly can in the time. So I've got a couple of hands there. Let's go for the woman there.
Hi, I'm Shana. I have multiple sclerosis and I'm here with the Multiple Sclerosis Society. I just want to point out something and see if there's anything we can do about this. I have a social care budget. I feel very, very grateful for it. Part of the reason that I have it on direct payments is because 2 years after I was diagnosed, my husband left, having spent all the money from the business sale on drugs and alcohol. So I have nothing, and therefore everything kicked in. The trap I'm in is that I can't have a relationship with someone without them becoming responsible for my social care and any money they have being taken, either to pay for it or for that responsibility falling on them. And it's a horrible, horrible position because I meet lovely guys and I want to date, and yet I'm going, I can't, this will happen to you. And I'm really scared about my future, both being single, I can't have children, and at what point are they going to say, actually, you're old enough now, we're going to take away your social care budget and you can have 15 minutes three times a day because that's all you're going to need now. So that was my question, is there any way we can look at a way around that?
Goodness, thank you very much for that. And where was the other hand I waved at? Yes, please.
Thank you. Can I ask Debbie, please, is it Labour policy to have a unified health and social care pathway, or indeed parity, at the very least for dedicated care coordinators for elderly, disabled, perhaps blind people? And thank you very much, Eleanor, for raising those issues. I think in these times of austerity, maybe one way for public opinion to be less supportive of lowering taxes and reducing spending is maybe if people in positions of budgetary responsibility in councils, that this lady Dawn was saying, if they're faced with almost immoral choices in terms of provision of care, could there be a way, possibly through the Labour Party or the CAB, where they're supported to speak up and say, look, this is what we're faced with, people need to know?
Debbie, three great questions.
It really were three great questions. Could I start with Dawn? Shona, beg your pardon. I had Shona down, and then I thought I heard somebody say.
I'm just sat here. It's fine.
I mean, I just found that, you know, the position that you've been placed in by the inept system that we have at the moment, just we must do better than this. We have to improve. So you shouldn't be put in this position. Now, I've been in the job for nine days now, but I, and certainly, you know, we are four and a half years away from an election. But within those 4.5 years, we need to be coming up with some sensible solutions so that you, and I'm sure you're not alone. I bet you do feel lonely though, don't you? In your current predicament, and
yes. There's no way out.
Yeah. So we must do better than this. We really must. And I, you know, hopefully that we can you know, have a chat afterwards and you know. Definitely stay in contact. So my point on that is, got to do better. There has to be a solution after that, on that one. In terms of the point that was made about past, I didn't catch your name.
Sorry.
Robbie. You made about what is our policy around integrated health and social care. That's certainly the platform that we stood on in the general election, that we would have an integrated health and social care system. We thought that there is a lot that we can gain, not just in terms of making sure that we have care pathways that are integrated, but that there will be opportunities in terms of making a system a lot more efficient than it currently is. And part of that is as well for older people in particular was looking about having a designated one person that you could link into. So that is that was definitely the as I say, the platform that we stood on during
the
election.
Just say really quickly, I was my late mother's carer. I was right at the sharp end of this.
Yeah.
And I was constantly going between various individuals within the National Health and the Social Services. So a coordinator is great.
Yeah.
And at the end of her life, I had to defend her against what was the Liverpool pathway. So I would urge the panel, if there are any movements again raising the issue of assisted dying and legislation to support that, I would urge the panel to show extreme caution. You know, because if my mum didn't have me to battle for her, her support system at the end of her life would have been withdrawn. I wouldn't let that happen. Excuse me.
Well, no, thank you very much for raising what is obviously a very personal thing, and I think you obviously did your mum proud, and and again, I'd love to carry on the dialogue in terms of what we can learn from your personal experience there. We, as I said, we've got 4.5 years before the next election. What we're absolutely determined to do is make sure that we start this dialogue now. We have a lot to build on. We had some good ideas.
People suffering.
Absolutely. I talked about some of the people that I that I have who've come to my surgeries, but also I meet just casually when I've been out in the door knock. The point that was raised around how we look to support people from, you know, the intergenerational inequalities that exist and how we support them and what method we use. I didn't hear John's speech in full. I had another meeting, so I will be looking at that in the next few hours, I'm sure. But I think it is still an open book. We need to, I think your point about making sure that we don't penalise particularly people from not necessarily wealthier groups, but certainly people on middle incomes who are also struggling, and making sure that both middle income and lower income people, we know the, you know, all the evidence currently shows how people on lower incomes and middle incomes have been absolutely hammered over the last five years. And we need to make sure that there is a fairer distribution of taxation burden. So, and I'll be looking forward to lobbying our new Shadow Chancellor to make sure that we have a fairer taxation system.
I think it's just really, really, let's take 5 seconds. I know I'll take a lot of time. I really do think that people in positions of budgetary responsibility in local councils, in county councils, in hospitals, in health authorities should be supported somehow to be able to speak out about the situations they're facing, the choices they're making.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to take 2 more contributions and then I'll open it up to the rest of the panel. So who would like to make... we've got a gentleman here. Anyone else want to... Yeah, so first you and then...
Jeff Themister from the... I'm with the campaigns team at RNIB. Much of the discussion has been about the parlous state of social care funding, which of course is quite right, and the idea of some sort of integration of health and social care services is obviously the answer. So that makes no sense to supposedly protect health expenditure while you're building up this car crash with social care, which is only going to put pressure on the health system. And Janice also mentioned the much neglected area of housing policy and that as well, which needs to be part of the picture. A temptation I think we need to resist, though, is the idea of raiding disability benefits in order to help to pay for that. Previous Labour government did, of course, suggest dissolving attendance allowances for social care kitty, and eventually decided that would be a bad idea, and indeed the Tories said that they wouldn't do it as well back in 2010. Disabled people use those benefits, DLA, PIP, attendance allowance, to keep them out of the heavy end of social care dependency. Yeah. We did research at RNIB that demonstrated how blind and partially sighted people use their attendance allowance, somebody to do shopping, somebody to do gardening, taxis to get out and about, a handy person to do things around the house. And certainly without that, they would have slid down towards the heavy dependency end and exacerbated the problem. So very much argue that temptation needs to be resisted and we need to protect those.
Thank you. And then the woman behind.
I'm Jason Loftus from Arthritis Research UK. We're very conscious that with an aging population, there will be a greater number of people living with arthritis for longer. One thing we're also conscious is that there are risk factors that are modifiable, such as physical inactivity and obesity. Yeah. I'd be very interested to hear the panel's thoughts about how we can have a preventative approach. Yeah. We're trying to keep people physically active and independent for longer. And how do we do so in a time where budgets are very much being squeezed for local partners who, of course, have got good health?
Yeah, another area which isn't part of the NHS ring fence and therefore potentially at risk. Let me go down the panel, starting with Ellie.
Okay, well, thank you. The first thing that really strikes me, Tracy, your comment, how do we help people to stay healthy and physically active and so on? In fact, that's one of the main things that, to Jeff's point, that blind and partially sighted people tell us they use benefits for. For assistance at the gym or for getting out and about and staying active. So I think those two things quite neatly come together to support the idea that we absolutely must not start raiding disability benefits. Disability benefits are for particular things and reasons, and that they are not there to plug gaps in social care or indeed NHS funding. And I know that lots of people within particularly Disability Labour, which is a group within the Labour Party of disabled members, there are grave concerns about what, how can I describe it? Perhaps a lack of clarity in terms of policy about things like the Independent Living Fund, where we saw a bit of a U-turn, and other areas. So I think whilst it's quite easy to say we mustn't raid those benefits, I really will be supporting Debbie and colleagues within the party to have some quite difficult policy discussions to make sure that the positions we come to are, you know, are generated by party members who have lived experience of disability and who can, you know, really help to develop that policy.
Thanks. Dawn?
I'll pick up on various bits of the questions in a big rambling speech. I'll apologise in advance. So one of the things I find really interesting is, I mean, especially in the last 5 years, I definitely lay a lot of the blame at the door of the media, of which I am part, but also the Conservative government, is around the rhetoric around disability. And I'm a woman with multiple disabilities, but they're invisible disabilities, and most people don't realise I have them until I tell people. And I think there's so little understanding around disability that it massively impacts on people's lives. I spoke to a group of psychiatrists recently who walked 100 miles from Leicestershire to London to raise awareness of the impact that cuts were having on their client, on their clients and their patients. And one of the stories that really stuck with me was a woman had been in a car crash and she was going to see a psychiatrist to help her with the trauma. And he said to her, "I think a good thing for you to do would be to leave the house and go for a walk around your local park for half an hour a day." And she said, "I can't. I don't want to leave the house and be seen to be walking because my neighbours will think I'm not disabled and then I'll get and then I'll be shopped to the DWP." And unfortunately, he knew that wasn't paranoia. That was something that could happen. And a lot of it comes from the onslaught, as you said, on DLA, on the personal independence payment, basically on the massive, massive clampdown on disability benefits and this rhetoric that says that a lot of people who are disabled are either faking their disability or just work shy. And there's such a massive, massive misunderstanding of disability and the levels and spectrums of disability. And I think there's a certain amount of political expediency that comes with that. So I'd like to see more understanding of exactly what is and isn't health. And I think health is a spectrum, to be honest. And your point about how we can look more at preventative measures, I mean, especially with arthritis and that sort of thing. There's a massive correlation with poverty and health. I mean, a lot of my friends who are very wealthy are able to go to, you know, very good gyms and get personal trainers. I see a lot of children now who do almost no exercise because their local park has been demolished and had luxury flats built on it, or basically the parents are too scared to let them cross several roads and go to a youth club, and the youth club isn't there anymore, and they used to play basketball, and now they can't because the cuts have closed it. So I think more investment in public space. And also more investment in, like, after school clubs and, you know, and more kind of, you know, quite accessible social things. I went to a really, really amazing pensioners wheelchair basketball game recently, which was absolutely fantastic. And I spoke to the people who were involved afterwards, and all of them said that they used to go to hospital several times a year, and now they're going maybe once or twice for a small checkup. And that's something that doesn't cost very much, but brings a lot of joy to people, and helps the NHS massively, because these people aren't going to hospital constantly. They're having, you know, they have social and emotional contact, and they're actually a lot more kind of active than they ever were. So I think that sort of thing, like actually looking at how much you can save the NHS and how much you can save the social care budget, purely by allowing people to do one or two things that take a bit of money on the outset. On inheritance tax, just to go back to your point at the beginning, I'm actually really, really, really pro-inheritance tax. And that's because it affects an absolutely tiny number of people who can genuinely really take the hit. And the people who at the moment are being cut and who are really, really hurt are the people who have almost nothing. So it's always the disabled people who can't work I speak to who've had their benefits cut. I spend a lot of time writing about council tax because I'm a massive nerd. And what a lot of people might not realise is that most councils in the UK now have removed council tax benefit. So a lot of people who didn't used to pay council tax now have to pay council tax. And these are people who are the poorest people in society, suddenly being told that they have to pay £10 a week council tax, and they can't pay it. And so what happens is, because council tax is one of the only things, it's one of the only debts that you can go to prison for, these people are being summoned to court and for debts of £40-50, and then have court charges of £200 put on top of that, and these people are absolutely terrified. I spoke to a young single mother who had a disabled son, and I knocked on her door and I went in, and after 15 minutes of talking to her, I heard a noise and her son crawled out from behind the sofa, and I thought he was just playing around, and then she said, "I'm really, really sorry. Every time somebody knocks on the door, he thinks it's a bailiff." So I think if these people are getting cut, people who are eligible for inheritance tax, who are very wealthy anyway, they can take the cut and not the people at the bottom.
I mean, what your story is, I really want to interrupt. what your story is saying is that the balance here is so difficult because the working age benefit system has taken the most appalling hit, and it's right to protect the pension system, but you know, not in the way that is currently, you know, having such a big hit on particularly families with children. Janet.
Okay, I want to talk about two things. One is about prevention, and one is about the inheritance tax issue. On prevention, I think the sad point is that the case has been made, and I think everyone in local government understands that prevention works, and investment early on, enabling people to remain independent for longer, will save money downstream for social care and health interventions. However, the reality is local authorities have got to cut their cloth, and so they are focusing on those with most critical and substantial needs, and so I think those lower level services are under threat. However, the good news is there are some really interesting models, and I would refer you to, I'm a founder member of the Campaign to End Loneliness. Mm-hmm. There was a publication called Promising Approaches, which was published by the Campaign and by Age UK, and it identified lots of very interesting models that look at using asset-based approaches that enable people to, for small amounts of intervention, utilise their own skills and resources, but also the community resources, and reconnect them to those through things like social prescriptions and other approaches. And as I mentioned earlier, and I'm not flogging this particular project that I'm involved with, but I think it's a very interesting model. I'm involved with the Social Finance Initiative that's got upfront social finance money come into it, and it will be paid back by the CCG for reducing loneliness of older people by reconnecting them to services and remeasuring how lonely they are. And that they will be paid because there has been a cost base identified about the downstream costs that the CCG will pay, because otherwise they would have been paying for GPs, hospital admissions, residential care or domiciliary care. And that is being tested to see over 5 or 6 years whether that could pay back the initial investment made by social finance. That's not an answer for everyone or everything, but there are some interesting ways that we need to think about how we can, at this point, still invest in prevention. I think perhaps, hopefully, if we start to bounce back later, we've got the framework in the Care Act to start reinvesting public money at a better rate in preventive services. Mm. So hopefully if we do bounce back. But going to this issue about better off people having to pay more inheritance tax, I would rather not get into inheritance tax because I'm not political. But I think the honest thing we have to say is the level of demand for health and social care in this country is going to be so high that we will all have to pay more in whatever way, because the state will really only be able to focus on those who simply can't help themselves. And I think we've got to be more honest about that. So whether or not those who are well off will have to pay more at some point, and whether that's inheritance tax or actually, and I might disagree with Dawn about something she said earlier, actually people will have to sweat their assets. They will have to sell their homes to pay for their care. We need to give them fair ways, like the deferred payment scheme under the Care Act, or through equity release or whatever, to be able to do that in a fair way. But they understood that that might happen. But those that can will have to pay more, I believe. And I also think that we are all going to have to do more for ourselves. So we're going to have means to plan for our own future and save for our future. Because we are going to have to pay for ourselves more. We're going to have to invest in our own health and in our own staying active and remaining in our communities and all of that. And we're going to have to do more to help our families if we can, because we can't expect the state to do it if we don't do it ourselves. So I think that I do think we've got to have a more honest debate about that. It isn't someone, older people is not someone else's responsibility. It's our own towards our families, and then the state will have to pick up really on a very massive gap for those who can't support themselves.
Great, thank you. We're almost out of time, but I don't think we've heard enough from the audience, so I want to just pick up a few very short comments. So who would like to make a comment or question? You're out of, it's 9 o'clock, you've lost all your energy from the day. Anyone else? Yes, gentleman in the back.
I'm Fabian, I live out in Berkshire. Some time back, there was a programme about social care comparing this country and Scandinavia. And okay, it's a different temperament, but in Scandinavia, people would prefer the state to look after their elderly, yep, and therefore pay the necessary taxes.
They pay high taxes.
Not prepared to pay the taxes. And sometimes you
get what you pay for.
Look after you, feel responsibility for your relative, depends on the family.
Yeah, thank you. Anyone else want to come in before we close up? Very quickly, as you've had a go already. Yeah.
Point, something I want to mention in relation to what Janet was saying, the way to pay for things is to grow an economy. An economy, you can stimulate economy by reducing taxes. You can also stimulate an economy by borrowing and spending to a degree. Mm. The beauty is in the balance. And I think that's probably what the Shadow Chancellor would have spoken about today. I haven't had a chance to catch up with it. Don't subscribe wholeheartedly that austerity is the only way.
No, I'm not.
You can reduce. No, I'm not suggesting that. But yes, yeah. But there's been a lot of propaganda about that. Taxes can be reduced. Money can be borrowed and spent as well. It's a balance to grow an economy.
Yeah.
You grow an economy, you can afford things.
Yeah, I think we will have to pay more taxes as well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And we will have to pay for ourselves if we can, yes, as well.
Can I quickly say, Chair, about prevention? I think prevention is an important thing to, you know, to the people who are blind and partially sighted issues. And as Ellie said earlier, about prevention is a way of keeping people more independent, or trying to keep people independent and more health and well-being. Because if you can look at prevention, you're probably going to save money in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, this last week's been about eye week. You know, if people get a yearly eye checkup, it might stop them getting cataracts or different eye conditions. I'm not trying to have a go at anybody, but they, you know, prevention sometimes is a good thing in the long run. So I would emphasise that. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm going to ask each of our panellists just to speak for 30 seconds, very briefly. Janet, do you want
I've never spoken for 30 seconds in my life. That's absolutely impossible. I think we need to involve the public, and I think we need cross-party agreement to involve the public in a debate about what kind of future of health and social care do we want for our ageing population and for ourselves.
Thank you. Dawn?
I think I basically disagree with Janet. And, that's good. But I just think as a society we have to realise that we're all going to get old, and the likelihood is that most of us will get at least one disability. And we have to think about responsibility in society, and that means like to each other, but also fiscally. So we do have to get the government to invest in social care.
There's nothing less attractive to the population generally, and you know, an electorate if you're that way inclined, but people generally, than being seen to be playing political games with these issues around social care and health. So would absolutely support what Janet says about cross-party solutions. We tried to get there before and it hasn't worked, but I think the time is absolutely right for that. And just I didn't talk about the inheritance tax thing earlier, and I did mean to, and this is a personal comment. just encouraging people to think about kind of what that means societally. So you know, obviously I'm, you know, a Labour politician, so you know, for me, an inclusive society in which we hugely value people's social networks and the social capital is vital, but I think that goes for everybody. And I don't believe that there are parts of society who essentially buy their way out of needing a community, and it worries me how often the notion of sort of community and how supportive everyone is only applied to deprived areas or poorer people or people who have disabilities.
Great, thank you very much. Just a quick plug, the Fabians have a piece of research coming out on public attitudes to tax, which will be out in October. It's pretty grim reading on inheritance tax, I have to...
I was going to say it's really exciting.
All our reports are exciting.
Of course.
Even among people who are supportive of progressive taxes and want wealth to be taxed more, they still hate inheritance tax. Mm. So the left has got a massive political problem with... It's a toxified tax, and I think we need to sort of almost start again on the taxation of wealth rather than trying to reform something that is hated so much. That's my Tappensworth. Thank you so much for all those great contributions, and from you from the floor. Particularly want to thank what has been a really great partnership with the RNIB and Independent Age, as well as Bright Blue and Centre Forum. Do read the report. It's a fantastic range of really good authors. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thanks.
Down the middle. But you're all right. Andrew,
2 years ago we spoke about the local elections.
Yeah.
And you said you were in the Peace Haven area.
Yes.
Well, I'm assuming that you have some connection down here. And that's Local Government Boundary Commission. You go to that site, their current reviews. Just only a week ago did it commence the review. And this time they're not doing it on a single basis, they're actually doing a county and its districts all together as an experiment.
Yeah.
Are you living?
No, I don't live. I live in London.
Right, you don't have any. You just came down here.
No, I have some family in this part of the world.
Okay, well, if they're in East Sussex rather than Brighton and Hove.
Then one's in Brighton, and the other's in West Sussex.
Oh, really? Okay, definitely. Yeah. Shall I leave that with you?
Not of our East Sussex.
No.
Not my patch.
I've got a ship.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
Are you coming to Tory
Conference? We haven't quite decided. Is it inside the zone, or do we need a pass?
It is inside the school zone.
Yeah. Given how much I have to pay for the furniture.
Thank you.
Yeah, we should catch up on.
Thanks very much.
The Hilton to Northern Can I come with you? Can I tell you that one for that way? Yeah. Okay. Cheers, everybody.